Welcome to the Shortwave Report for June 22, 2012. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can find a schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past five shortwave reports, get advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK World Radio Japan, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, Spanish National Radio, Radio Havana Cuba, and The Voice of Russia. We'll begin with NHK World Radio Japan. A group of local leaders are protesting the Japanese government's decision to restart a nuclear power plant. Following the Fukushima disaster, the United States created a map of the radiation spread, but the Japanese government did not make the information public. Japan will create a new nuclear regulatory body by September, one that does not promote nuclear power. Toshiba is going to build several large solar power stations near Fukushima. Egyptian election officials delayed releasing results for the presidential runoff election. NHK World Radio Japan.
A group of Japanese local leaders is protesting the government's decision to restart a nuclear power plant. The Oi nuclear plant in Fukui Prefecture will be the first to resume operation since all of Japan's reactors were shut down for safety checks. The group of 73 serving and retired mayors held a news conference on Sunday to protest a plan to put the Oi plant back online. The Secretary General of the group, Hiroko Uehara, read out a statement accusing the government of sidestepping efforts to ensure nuclear safety. The statement also criticized the decision to restart the Oi plant under makeshift safety standards and before setting up a new nuclear watchdog.
Japan's foreign ministry says the U.S. government created a map depicting the spread of radiation following the accident at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, but Japan's science ministry did not make the information public. The U.S. Energy Department created the map using data collected by U.S. aircraft from March 17th to 19th last year. The map shows radiation spreading northwest from the accident site. Parts of the map indicate levels of 125 microsieverts per hour. The figure suggests residents close to the plant were exposed to the annual permissible level within 8 hours. The U.S. provided the data through the Japanese Foreign Ministry to the Science Ministry and the Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency, but neither body released the information. They also failed to tell the Prime Minister's office about the data. The U.S. Energy Department posted the map on its website on March 23rd. Senior Science Ministry official Itaru Watanabe says he thought the U.S. government should release the information. He said the Japanese government publicized the results of its own radiation surveys at 180 locations.
Japan's Diet has enacted a law to set up a new nuclear regulatory body by September. The law enacted on Wednesday was prompted by criticism following last year's accident at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. Lawmakers have said the Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency is controlled by the Ministry of Economy, Trade and Industry, which promotes nuclear power. The planned new Nuclear Regulatory Commission is to be largely independent of the government and have control over a nuclear regulatory agency. Appointees to the commission are not to be allowed to return to work at their former ministries or agencies. A new cabinet office council is to be set up to study nuclear disaster preparedness. The new law limits the prime minister's powers to give orders during emergencies and tasks the commission with making decisions involving knowledge of reactor technology. The law allows the prime minister to give instructions only when the commission is too slow in deciding. The commission is to review the current 40-year limit for operating nuclear plants. The government plans to choose the commission's 5 members.
Japanese electronics maker Toshiba will build several solar power stations in a city near the disabled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Toshiba Managing Director Takeshi Yokota signed an agreement with the mayor of Minami-Soma, Katsunobu Sakurai, on Wednesday. Under the contract, the company will build a plant along the coast. The area is designated as a tsunami risk zone, where construction of new houses has been banned since last year's disaster. The city plans to buy 1.5 million square meters of land and lease it to a venture set up by Toshiba for the project. Construction will start in March and the plant will begin operating in 2014. They will provide up to 100 megawatts of electricity, enough to meet the demands of 30,000 homes. It will be the largest solar power plant project in Japan. Minami-Soma aims to end its dependence on nuclear power and eventually meet the power demands of all homes in the city with renewable energy. Mayor Sakurai says the project will serve as encouragement to residents as they work toward that goal. Egypt's election officials have delayed announcing the winner of the presidential runoff, saying they need to study complaints from the candidates. The election commission was supposed to announce the results on Thursday, but the commission said in a statement on Wednesday that it needs more time before declaring final results. Voting was held on Saturday and Sunday for the runoff between Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood and Ahmed Shafiq, a former military commander who served as ousted President Hosni Mubarak's last prime minister. Local media reports have put Morsi in the lead, but both candidates have declared victory, citing ballot numbers that they claim to have obtained from the election authorities. The Election Commission has not given new dates for declaring the winner, but officials have told local media that results are likely to be ready in a few days' time. It is feared that the release of the official results could raise tensions between supporters of the candidates, with a losing side almost certain to launch strong protests.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 10 p.m. to 10:30 at 6110 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. All the times I'm announcing are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so adjust them to your time zone. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Rhys Ehrlich reports from Libya on the fully restored oil exporting business while the country teeters on civil war. Julian Assange applied for political asylum to Ecuador. Radio Deutsche Welle.
Oil is one of the few success stories in today's Libya. Khalifa Saleh, operations manager here at the Zawiya oil refinery, shows me an enormous grid of pipes and tanks. He boasts that the facility has up-to-date equipment. The refinery even produces most of its own drinking water.
This is to produce water for drinking and for processing, and mainly for drinking.
Oh, I see. So it's a desalinization unit to turn seawater into drinking
water. That's right.
I asked Saleh if the refinery's production of gasoline and other fuels has reached pre-war levels.
The production today at 15 minutes after 11, the capacity is 102% capacities for both process units.
So it's over 100%.
Yes, please.
Oil is one of the few success stories in today's Libya. Shipments to Italy, France, Germany, and other countries are approaching pre-war levels. But the country's political system is far from successful. Armed militias vie for power with the central government. Some Libyans say the ongoing fighting could turn their country into another Afghanistan or Iraq. El Habib Alamin is a well-known poet and official with the Ministry of Culture. He fears that Western powers will abandon Libya's struggle for democracy.
Those wars in Afghanistan and Iraq didn't result in improvements for the people of those countries. I think some leaders here in Libya are trying to get Western backing to become the next Hamid Karzai. I don't want Libya to become an ATM for Western oil companies while they abandon the people of the country.
Foreign oil companies are a sore spot for Libyans because of the country's long history of corruption. Ibrahim Ali, chair of an NGO called the Libyan Transparency Association, says that the old regime were thieves. Oil would be sold at world market rates, but European companies actually bought the crude at much lower prices. He says the corporations and Gaddafi cronies pocketed the difference.
The real price outside is $10, and we find inside the contract, for example, $4 or $3. there's a corruption inside this contract. This difference, they will get it by commission outside, and you don't know. Till now, it's like that, you know, and nobody knows about these things, you know.
Ali and other NGO activists demand that the government publish the oil contracts, along with a detailed budget of how the Libyan government spends its current oil revenues. But the oil industry strongly objects. Ibrahim Lias, an official with Medco Energy Oil and Gas, says foreign oil companies don't want contract terms made public because one company may be getting a more advantageous deal.
The contracts between the oil companies and the NOC, that's very, very confidential. There is no third party can read it, you know, and it's confidential because each contract is unique by itself. You don't want even other companies to know about it. Some things they you don't want the public to see it.
Al-Amin says the oil companies will have to reveal their contracts sooner or later.
The Libyan people need transparency about the relationship between foreign countries and our government and about the economic contracts. Someday it will come out. If it's secret, the Libyan people will be very angry at the government.
Demonstrators here in the city of Benghazi are demanding an end to corruption and dissolving the militias. They look forward to elections for a National Assembly. The Assembly will choose a new government and be responsible for writing a new constitution. But protester Abdul Wahab says a new government will probably not resolve the issues of corruption and militias.
So this chaos and this disorganization will have to carry on for some years before we establish a firm nation with laws, a constitution that everybody adheres to.
Last year, NATO sent planes and ships to Libya with the stated goal of protecting civilians and promoting democracy. Libyans are now wondering if protecting oil resources, not building democracy, was its real goal. Wahab says Libyans worry that continued political chaos could produce a new dictator.
They're worried about a new strongman emerging.
Like a new strongman emerging using his own militia to impose his will upon the Libyan people.
I'm Reese Ehrlich, DW, Tripoli, Libya.
Julian Assange, the founder of the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks, took refuge in Ecuador's London embassy on Tuesday and applied for political asylum. Assange is in London fighting extradition to Sweden, where the authorities seek his arrest on charges of sexual misconduct against two women during a 2010 visit. The Australian national may still seek an appeal before a European court in Strasbourg. Assange is concerned that if he's handed over to the Swedish authorities, he could be extradited to the United States for prosecution.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, mediacenter.dw-world.de. On to Spanish National Radio. A brief report on the G20 summit and the proposed Eurozone bank. On the sidelines of the G20 summit, BRICS leaders said that they will enhance their contributions to the IMF to help protect countries from fallout from the Eurozone debt crisis. The Rio Plus 20 summit opened in Brazil with a proposed agreement that many felt was far too weak. Spanish National Radio.
At the end of the G20 summit of the world's industrialized nations held in Mexico, Europe won support from international leaders for an ambitious but slow-moving overhaul of the Eurozone, even as pressure built in financial markets for quicker solutions to its debt crisis that threatens the world economy. Europe told the G20 it intends to work on concrete steps to integrate its banking sector, a major step long pressed by the United States and other nations to break the cycle of debt-laden countries bailing out their troubled banks, which only pushes governments even deeper into debt. US President Barack Obama said the sense of urgency amongst European leaders was clear, and they knew what steps were needed to break the fever of an escalating debt crisis. Back here in Europe, Spanish and Italian bond yields have fallen following the G20 summit. The yield on Spain's 10-year bonds fell to 6.86%, dropping below the dangerous 7% level of the past couple of days. For Italian bonds of the same maturity, the yield was down to 5.84%. At the end of the G20 summit, Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy said these rates did not correspond to Spain's real economic situation. It's evident that the fundamentals of the Spanish economy are much better than the risk premium and the price we are currently paying for our debt would suggest. Spain is the fourth largest economy in the Eurozone and has the equivalent of 50% of its gross domestic product invested abroad.
Also in Mexico, on the sidelines of the main summit, the leaders of the so-called BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, have said they will enhance their own contributions to the IMF to help protect countries from fallout from the Eurozone debt crisis. But they insisted that the money be used only after existing funds were depleted. According to the IMF, Brazil, Russia, and India each pledged $10 billion, while South Africa offered $2 billion, Mexico has also contributed $10 billion, and China has offered $43 billion. IMF boss Christine Lagarde said the resources were being made available for crisis prevention and to meet the potential financial needs of all IMF members. The total pledges have reached $456 billion, which would almost double the fund's lending capacity. In return, the BRICS want more say at the Washington-based fund by boosting their voting power as shareholders.
Many of the leaders who were in Mexico for the G20 summit have now moved on to Brazil, where negotiators have agreed a text to be approved at the Rio Plus 20 summit intended to put society on a more sustainable path. The gathering, which is being attended by more than 100 leaders, comes 20 years after the Earth Summit, also held in the Brazilian city. The text has yet to be ratified by heads of government and ministers, but it seems that no changes will be made. It calls for urgent action on unsustainable production and consumption, but it gives no detail or a timetable on how this can be achieved and no clear direction as to how the world economy can be put on a greener path. Environment groups and charities working on poverty issues believe the agreement is far too weak. The European Union is also unhappy with the level of ambition in the text, in particular Denmark, which holds the EU presidency. The Danish Environment Minister said Europe would have liked to see a much more concrete and ambitious outcome. For the United States, lead negotiator Todd Stern described the deal as a good step forward. Developing countries might have agreed to go further if developed countries had offered tangible financial support, but they did not do so.
Those reports were from Spanish National Radio, heard from 5 to 6 p.m. at 6055 and podcasting at www.rtve.es. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. The People's Summit, held alongside the G20 Summit, rejected the prevailing neoliberal policies as illegitimate. Bolivian President Morales will present a bill on the rights of Mother Earth at the Rio Summit. Iran has denounced the deployment of U.S. troops in Kuwait. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The Mexican social organizations and delegations from more than 30 countries that participated in the People's Summit rejected the G20 Summit and the prevailing neoliberal policies in today's world. The People's Summit ran parallel to the 7th G20 Summit, which concluded Tuesday in the resort area of Los Cabos in Mexico. A communique issued by participants of the People's Summit termed the meeting in Los Cabos of leaders of the industrialized nations and the world's emerging economies as illegitimate. The text reads, "Note the G20 crew because they represent the oppressors and serve the interests of big capital and speculators over people's rights." Signatories of the document call to strengthen unity among the social movements worldwide towards creating a new, more equitable world order that truly controls and regulates international monetary and the financial systems. Bolivian Senate passed a bill on Mother Earth, which will be presented by the Andean country's President Evo Morales at the United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development underway in the Brazilian city of Rio de Janeiro. Senator for the Movement Towards Socialism, Amalia Antonio, said that this piece of legislation seeks to establish a fundamental vision of development in harmony with nature and in defense of life. The legislator said that the projected law should also increase public awareness of the need to reduce pollution and prioritize human life instead of industrial development throughout Latin America and Europe. Once passed, the law will establish sanctions against those who violate the rights of Mother Earth without parole or the benefits of suspension of the sentence. Iran has denounced the deployment of U.S. troops in Kuwait, calling attention to a U.S. congressional report that documents many U.S. troops withdrawn from Iraq and the redeployed in Kuwait. According to reports from Washington, the United States is planning a significant military presence of up to 13,500 troops in Kuwait. The study by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee examined U.S. relationship with the six nations of the Gulf Cooperation Council, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman. The U.S. Senate report provides precise numbers on U.S. forces in Kuwait, a presence that Pentagon officials have only acknowledged on condition of anonymity. The report says there are currently about 15,000 U.S. forces in Kuwait at several military and air bases, giving the U.S. tagging hubs, training ranges, and locations to provide logistical support in Iraq and threaten Iran. The report said the number of troops is likely to drop to 13,500. U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has said he envisions about 40,000 troops stationed in the Middle East region after the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba, heard from 1 to 2 p.m. at 11760 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6060, 6050, or 6000. Also streaming on the web from 6 p.m. to midnight at www.radiohc.cu. And now podcasting at World Radio Network, which is WRN.org. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or would like to make a donation for production costs of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California 95490. Please support independently produced radio. We will conclude with the voice of Russia. With numerous undeclared wars spreading across the African continent, the U.S. military will increase troop deployments there next year. And AFRICOM has increased covert spying using private contractors and their aircraft. The voice of Russia.
Just as the war in Afghanistan is winding down, it seems as if the undeclared wars in Africa are being ramped up. Mass media is reporting that the U.S. Army will deploy thousands of soldiers across the continent of Africa in 2013. The Army Times recently ran a story confirming that the U.S. military gave the go-ahead for the mass deployment last month and that roughly 3,000 soldiers will soon be sent overseas, with more troops expected to be dispatched as needed. Major General David Hoag, head of U.S. Army Africa, says the initiative is part of a regionally aligned force concept that will allow American troops to forge relationships across Africa. Hoag told the Army Times, "As far as our mission goes, it's uncharted territory."
More than 1,200 U.S. soldiers are currently stationed at Camp Lemonnier at Djibouti, and last October, U.S. President Barack Obama personally authorized the deployment of 100 troops to Uganda to aid in an attempt to oust Lord's Resistance Army leader Joseph Kony. In an interview, award-winning war correspondent Eric Margolies said that if Washington had humanitarian interests in mind while considering deployments to Uganda, then it would not be going in alone. In an interview, Margolies continued by saying, "The U.S. is also concerned about Chinese penetration in the region, that they're going to gobble up all the economic resources and earn influence on the regional governments. So maybe the U.S. wants to stop this Chinese advancement in Central Africa."
In addition to the public statements, U.S. military planners have also made covert moves. According to Defense Department documents and people involved in the project, the U.S. military is expanding its secret intelligence operations in Africa, establishing a network of small air bases to spy on terrorist hideouts from the fringes of the Sahara to jungle terrain along the equator. To further disguise the mission, the U.S. military has taken another unusual step. It has largely outsourced the spying operation to private contractors.
In June of 2010, the Africa Command participated in an industry day to drum up interest. More than 50 private contractors were invited to develop proposals to expand programs aimed at combating Al-Qaeda in Africa. Unclassified documents prepared for the event showed that the military wanted contractors to provide at least a combined 44 personnel for the programs, with double that number if the Africa Command decided to surge either one of them. At a minimum, contractors were told that they would have to keep planes flying for 150 hours a month.
The contractors would have to supply the surveillance gear, including electro-optical and infrared sensors that work in the dark, and a laser-emitting sensor that can peer under the jungle canopy. Everything had to be concealed within the body of the plane with retractable mounting to avoid attracting suspicion. Another document stipulated that prospective firms fly innocuous aircraft that would blend into the local operating area. In a PowerPoint presentation posted on a federal government website, the African Command warned firms bidding for the work that African countries would be uncomfortable with activities that might look suspicious, adding, "Don't want covert aircraft, just friendly-looking aircraft."
The practice of hiring private companies to spy on huge expanses of African territory does have its pluses and minuses. Unlike uniformed troops, plainclothes contractors are less likely to draw attention. But because the arm's length arrangement exists outside traditional channels, there is virtually no public scrutiny or oversight. And if something goes wrong, the U.S. government and its partners acknowledge that the contractors are largely on their own.
Peter Singer, a Brookings Institution senior fellow and an expert on military contracting, said the Pentagon typically turns to the private sector for deniability. But he added that it rarely turns out that way. He said, "When things go bad, you can have two scenarios. Either the contractors are left holding the bag, complaining about abandonment, or else some kind of abuse happens and they're not held accountable because of a mix of unclear legal accountability and a lack of political will to do something about it."
Contractors knowledgeable about the Central African mission appear to be aware that the downing of one of their planes could have far-reaching implications. In response to a U.S. Africa Command solicitation to expand operations, one defense firm wrote in May 2010, "From a purely political standpoint, it is obvious the fallout of such an incident would be immense, especially if hostile forces reach the crash site first. This could turn into a prisoner-hostage situation at worst or a serious foreign relations incident, highly damaging to both AFRICOM and the United States."
That report was from the Voice of Russia. Russia is now heard from 6 p.m. to 11 at 15425-9800 and 9665 or through their website www.english.ruvr.com. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time. Please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcast using a shortwave radio at home. It's far simpler than you might think. However, if you use the internet, listening globally is also quite easy. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, make a safe donation through PayPal, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.